in the middle. I'm Joey Block. Well, we have some news here for you. A little bit of a headline was kind of in the news this week, but now it's kind of moving out here. First Lady Jill Biden has tested positive for COVID once again, but now the White House says she's negative. So we, regardless of your political stripes, we want to extend our thoughts to the First Lady. We are glad to hear that she is doing well and that she is making a good recovery there. She was experiencing mild symptoms at the time of the test. Biden stayed at her beach house in Delaware ever since, while the president went back to Washington. So here's the deal, and this is why we're getting into the bit of the controversy here. Now, of course, we're glad that regardless of your political stripes and where you lean on anything, whether you're biased, unbiased, and what you do, you want people to be well. So we are glad to see that, and we're glad to see that the president has so far not tested positive. But he was there. They were together. You may recall the last time President Biden and the First Lady appeared in public together was when they were surveying the damage from Hurricane Idalia in Florida last weekend. Then they took a little weekend trip to the house in Rehoboth Beach, and they were together. And that's where the First Lady found out she tested positive. Then they separated the two. Now, you're probably saying, well, that's good. They're separated. But, you know, the reality is, we all know, and that's why the critics are saying that the two, when you're in that type of exposure together, you chances are you are exposed. Now, the president, he went back to Washington. He did his own little thing. She stayed down there. And critics of the president are blasting him for not following CDC protocols. Let me explain. Typically, when you are exposed to COVID, you are to be wearing masks in public at all times. Now, the president, according to these critics, took some liberties in that. Sometimes he was wearing one, sometimes he wasn't. But the moment that was most notable was when he was at a Medal of Honor ceremony this week at the White House, where he was in close proximity to an elderly soldier while not wearing a mask. And there were also other times where, you know, he was kind of like, oh, well, I should, well, I shouldn't. And Republicans were saying it's hypocritical because he was pushing the masks on everybody back when he first got in, and now who cares? But again, you have Biden's got a political tightrope he has to walk here. It's very sensitive. Now, why do you say that? Well, here's the deal. He wants you to believe, because he is going into a re-election, Biden has to have the perception of this is great. Things are getting back together. COVID is gone. It's under control. It may not necessarily be gone, but it's kind of like the flu now. No need to worry about it. We don't need to take any special precautions, don't mask or nothing. It's just like a regular flu season, you know. You wash your hands, you do the best you can. But here's the deal. He has to also deal with the fact that what got him elected was that everyone was in lockdown and that the Trump administration received all this negative feedback about their performance in that area, and that how former President Trump is telling people not to wear masks and questioning the authenticity of the masks and whether we should be using them or not, and also not really pushing the vaccine so forcefully in the beginning, while President Biden was a big advocate for the vaccine, even though it was under the Trump administration, which Operation Warp Speed happened. So Biden has that, and Democratic voters at large are COVID conscious. So he has to keep that in mind in order not to alienate them. But at the same time, he's got to deal with the average person who's going to be wondering, why the hell am I putting my mask back on? Because there are some people, now some people will go back to it, you know, they see the numbers, they'll see the data, they'll go back. But there are some who are just disgusted with the whole thing. And if they see him and his family having to take all these special precautions, then, you know, it isn't a good political move, because especially in light of that polling, you see that CNN put out that big poll where 60% of Democrats want someone else other than Biden as their nominee. Well, here's the problem. They couldn't list or coalesce around another single person. You know, you got RFK Jr. out there. You have Marianne Williamson out there. But you don't have the electorate moving towards them at this moment. Now, in some polls, between the two of them, they are getting 30% of the vote or close to it, which in and of itself is quite remarkable, because typically for an incumbent president, they're getting 80, 90% of the vote. It's not even a contest. There wouldn't even be a major primary challenge. I mean, look at Trump. The biggest competitor he had was Bill Weld, some guy from Massachusetts, a former governor there. He's a Republican. Then he joined the Libertarian Party. You may remember he was the running mate for Gary Johnson back in 2016. And then he switched his party affiliation to become a Republican to run against Trump. Didn't really go anywhere, because probably most of you don't even remember his name or that he even exists. He did. There were about two other guys who ran, but they dropped out quick. There really wasn't much interest in them. Those people probably couldn't even get close to 10%. It was not that big of a contest. While with Biden, you have RFK Jr. pulling some big numbers in particular, and Marianne Williamson isn't doing too bad herself. So when you have all that combined, Biden has to make things look like they're doing great. Because if you look at the polling, people are skeptical about the economy. They're skeptical about the infrastructure and all that. And, you know, you see all these positive economic numbers out there. But the reality is inflation is still a problem for a lot of people out there. And they're still concerned about that. The gas prices went up a little bit. Now you have OPEC cutting oil. And that is the struggle Biden's got to deal with. He has to make things, everything's A-okay. It's going to be great. We're going to a re-election. We're killing it. But if it's not, it's a problem. So that mask is an optics thing for him. So we're going to see how he handles that. And on top of that, he's heading to the G20 summit in New Delhi, despite critics saying he should stay home. Because again, when you are exposed, you kind of got to take it easy a little bit. Now you don't have to isolate the same way you used to, but you know, if you got to wear a mask, and if you don't feel comfortable wearing a mask in a certain situation, then maybe you shouldn't be in that situation. That is what a lot of these critics are blasting him for. So what the president's going to do, well, nothing really looks like it's going to change there. We're going to have to see what his masking situation is there. But the fact is that he tested negative and the first lady tested negative. You know, it probably means that he's going to go on as business as usual until otherwise noted. So we'll have to see if anything happens to the president. Godspeed to the president. Obviously, we don't want anything to happen to him. But it could be something to watch here, that the optics of, hi, I'm just getting over, my wife is just getting over COVID. Let me shake your hand real quick. Let me get in your personal space. We'll see how the world leaders respond to that, whether there's other news coming out of that. And again, it goes back to re-election. He's got to be on the world stage. So Biden making it a big priority to go to that G20 summit with the leaders of all these other countries. We'll have to watch how that plays out. But let's bring it home here to New Jersey, because big development there. Big bomb dropped by the DOJ and the federal government. The Justice Department has found state-run veterans homes here in New Jersey were underprepared to protect residents from COVID during the pandemic. In a 43-page report, the DOJ outlined how facilities in Menlo Park and Paramus led to dozens of deaths, citing poor communication, lack of staff competency, failing to group residents into cohorts by COVID exposure, not properly using PPE, and didn't maintain improvements made by the VA after the agency came in to help, among other things. So these are just the big highlights here. Then the report also says there's still problems in these nursing homes. The nursing facilities are reportedly not training their staff nor enforcing any COVID protocols to prevent infection. So this is a lot of what you've been hearing about on the scene here about, oh, we really need this investigation. You've had state legislators who have called for this investigation. Then you had others like members of the Democratic side saying, well, hold on, let's wait till we're going to rely on the federal government investigation here. Well, you have people on the Republican side are like, well, we want to investigate this. We need to do our own investigation. And this is on top of an independent investigation that has been launched by Governor Murphy himself for a long time. He said, oh, we're gonna launch an investigation. He didn't do it till after the election, but he did ultimately do that late last year. But we're not going to have those findings before the November legislative elections. But we have this one right here, and it'll be interesting to see whether they have the same findings or whether they're different and how it ultimately plays into one another. Well, Governor Murphy is responding. He called the report disturbing and says there's more work to be done here. And that is something that will be interesting to see where the political gravity goes with Governor Murphy. Because right now, yeah, he got a lot of outrage for this, but the issue didn't really hurt him in the polling, because as you saw, Jack Chitarelli, his Republican opponent in the last election, hammered him with this stuff, did a lot so in the debates. He got some good praise for that. You know, it seemed like they were putting a lot of this on TV, but it ultimately didn't do anything. But there is one important note that comes from the reporting from NJ.com, the Star Ledger. And we're going to have to see whether the reports pick this up. And it is that the Murphy administration was reportedly warned that patients could die if COVID patients are put back in nursing homes, that residents could die. And there is reportedly an audio recording about that. And we'll have to see where that plays in and what more depth we get into that. Supposedly Health Commissioner Judy Persichelli was on that call. We're going to have to see how that plays in, because if it does, we might start to see Republicans go more in on that, that they're going to dig in their heels and say, well, here's our issue. I mean, now you see them digging in here, because as you saw at the beginning of the year, you know, some interest that Republicans were going to do well, but then it looked like the Democrats were out raising them, and that the fundraising really wasn't going in the GOP's direction. But now you have this grassroots thing between the windmills that are going down in Jersey Shore. People are pissed off about that. Then you have the gender notification policy, which, as we saw from a Monmouth poll that came out a week or two ago, not very popular even among Democrats. And then we have this issue now. And then not to mention the high taxes of the state, which New Jerseyans often complain about property taxes. So we'll have to see if Republicans can make up on that momentum, or is it going to be about what the Democrats have laid out? Because let's go and see what the Democrats have done. They passed Stay and Jay, right? That was the big initiative, a part of Governor Murphy's budget, was Stay and Jay, basically a program to basically make it easier for seniors to live in New Jersey, lower the property taxes. But the kicker is, and the Republicans are criticizing them for this, it doesn't go into effect until 2026. So we'll have to see if the voters are optimistic enough that that's going to come, that they consider that good, that they feel better about it than the Anchor program, which gives a property tax break to property tax owners and renters within a certain income bracket. If people like that, and then top of that, some of the more social issues like codifying abortion into state law right before Roe v. Wade got struck down, then codifying gay marriage into state law, as well as interracial marriage. That got added this week. Whether if people like that, that could be a different part, especially if the Democrats, which you've already started to see in some of these local elections and these ads on TV, that they are trying to pin the Republicans as abortion extremists. So if that messaging works, then the Republicans may not benefit from it. But we're going to have to see which messaging works. And right now, Republicans are getting their fodder. We'll have to see whether the Democrats get theirs back. But here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. Former President Trump told a Fulton County judge in the Georgia 2020 election case that he may want to move his trial to federal court. In a court filing, Trump attorney Steve Sadow said the former president has 30 days to formally request the move after his written waiver. So he's saying the day that he waived his right to get arraigned, that he's just pleading not guilty here, 30 days out from that, that's how long he has to make this request. Now, you may recall that happened on August 31st. So, you know, move a little math around. That puts us around early October. And we'll have to see if he makes his move, because this comes as other defendants in the case, like former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, also are looking to move their trials to federal court. Mark Meadows in particular, that guy has been working really hard to try and get his case moved out of there, citing that he has immunity as the White House Chief of Staff because he did work on behalf of the president and behalf of the country, and that his work was protected under that, and that he has immunity that he's not going to get under Georgia state law. And, of course, Georgia law does allow this, so this is not out of the realm of possibility. Now, joining me to break this all down, whether this is actually going to happen or not, is Rutgers political science and law professor Joe Leo Carney Waterman. Professor, thanks for coming on.
I always appreciate the ask, Joey, and always appreciate being of help.
So I want to start off by talking about the latest of Trump's legal disputes, and that's what's going down in Georgia. Let's talk about that update. Former President Trump, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, among others, pled not guilty, opting out of an in-person arraignment, and just decided to do a court filing instead, which is allowed under Georgia law. Was that a good strategy on their part?
Well, it is in terms of optics. What it is essentially, the message that it's communicating to Ms. Willis as the DA and in general her office, but also to the nation, is that these defendants are of the opinion that the process is corrupt, that the process is political in nature. And in continuation or in furtherance of that view is what I should say, they've chosen not to give any more legitimacy to the process than is absolutely necessary. They certainly didn't want to be frog walked into the courthouse yet. Georgia law does prescribe that every individual who is indicted, render a mugshot or must be photographed, even though President Trump and Rudy Giuliani and quite frankly, several of the other defendants are extremely well known. Certainly after the events post-election, there is nowhere that many of them could go without being recognized. Whatever the case may very well be, the intention was to essentially say, we are not going to allow you to use us as political fodder, if you will. There's every reason to believe that DA Willis will, at the end of Brian Kemp's term, announce her intentions to run for governor. If not then, certainly later on. They did not want to do that, but they also did not want to confer any more legitimacy, I believe, on a process that they believe has been subverted by politics and therefore is inherently corrupt, at least from their perspective.
You bring that fact up, but it's important to note that Trump is a showman. He's a guy who likes to make a show and likes to fundraise off these indictments. I mean, if you just look back at the last few indictments that we've had, every time that there's been an indictment, Trump has raised more money. He's gone up further in the polls, and he's made this spectacle of getting on the plane, driving from the plane to wherever the courthouse is, having cameras all around. And in this case, compared to the other three cases, there actually would have been cameras in this courtroom had the former president and some of the other more high-profile defendants, they would have actually been recorded. Now, from a political perspective, why did Trump not want to be recorded? Because there, he can now be seen and possibly use it to fundraise even more.
Well, if you remember, Joey, in New York, he was photographed sitting at the defense, at the defendant's table in the courtroom. There wasn't live camera footage there, but there was definitely photographs. It's a very interesting thing that I've seen from President Trump. I have seen a discipline and a shrewdness about his public appearances and his public statements, not all of them, but a good number of them that I didn't even see in 2016. And I believe that the volume of cases against him, both civil and criminal, have essentially focused him and forced him to be very strategic. If for no other reason, then he is looking at a number of judges that are allegedly hostile to his interest. So, for instance, Judge Chutkan in D.C. makes it very clear that she will not hesitate if the president steps out of line to say something that she believes is or amounts to witness intimidation or in any way unnecessarily or inappropriately seating the jury with doubts about the process or, you know, things of that nature. And so I am quite sure that his legal team has told him that he has to be far more strategic and thoughtful about how he handles these particular matters. But going back to my initial response, Joey, I truly believe that the president had such disdain for this process that he considers to be inherently corrupt that he wasn't going to participate in it. But more than that, I believe the president believes that D.A. Willis is actually hungry for the sort of political scalp that he would represent. She's hungry for those camera moments of, you know, showing her standing in the courtroom as the prosecutor with President Trump, possibly leering at her in anger at the defense table. All of those would be very powerful pictures and play to what it is that she hopes to convey to the voters, that she is tough, she's no nonsense, that I represent the law and we will have law and order in Georgia. That, of course, is a very powerful and resonant theme for any campaign for executive office. And I think President Trump said, I am going to deprive her of that. I'm going to take from her what it is that she wants. And what's more is we see the, and I'll just lead into this, Joey, for the benefit of your listeners, we now see that former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows has moved to, he's filed a motion to remove the matter from Georgia, and more specifically Fulton County District Court, to the federal district court under a federal statute that I'm not going to quote to your listening audiences because I don't need to flex like that, but the statute essentially says that if you are trying a present or former federal official on or for behavior that they undertook while in the discharge of their duties, then that particular matter has to be heard by a federal court judge. And If Mark Meadows is successful in his motion, you can be rest assured that President Trump may very well follow suit. But Mark Meadows and others don't simply intend to transfer the matter out of Fulton County District Court to the federal district court for matters. They intend then to invoke presidential or, you know, presidential immunity or executive immunity, that essentially you cannot prosecute me for actions that were undertaken in furtherance of my job duties, right? And so President Trump is, or what Ms. Willis is looking at, is the unfortunate event that this particular matter could be transferred. And then once transferred, as you know, for the benefit of your listeners, there are no cameras, no photographs allowed in the court, in federal courtrooms anywhere. So there would be no spectacle thereafter. And so again, I truly believe that the president is being shrewd on this point in recognizing that Ms. Willis may very well have a political agenda, which isn't so far-fetched considering some of her previous actions regarding or regarding people involved in this case. But I don't want to give her that win. I don't want to give her that satisfaction. I don't want to give her that victory. And that, I believe, is a part of the calculus for the president.
Let's dive a little more. As you brought up the Mark Meadows aspect, is there are 19 people in this case. Now, at the arraignment this week, the judge denied a motion by Trump's former lawyers, Sidney Powell and Kenneth Chesbrough, to separate those defendants from each other. Essentially, they wanted to have separate trials, the two of them individually, but the judge said that, nope, you guys have to be charged together. And that date is set for October 23rd. But the judge has expressed some type of openness to charging the other 17 separate from them because the two of them want a speedy trial. And that's not necessarily the case of the other 17, especially in Mark Meadows' case, who wants to move it to the federal courts. Could we see separate trials happen? Because right now, the Fulton County DA's office, they are not having anything of it. They are still trying to keep all 19 together at the same time. Will we end up seeing 19 different trials?
Well, a number of things, Joey, could happen, and I'll try to give your listeners a very, very quick overview of a number of things that could happen. Number one, if Mark Meadows is successful in his motion for removal, and the judge determines that the matter should be removed to federal district court, all of the question of severance becomes essentially a moot point in that moment. I mean, they can certainly try to hear all of the defendants together, but more likely than not, the federal court judge would move to sever. And I'm not quite sure that President Trump necessarily wants his trial to be severed from Mark Meadows or any of the other federal employees like Jeff Clark and so many others. With Sidney Powell and Chesbrough, they were asking for speedy trial, and they were asking for an expedited trial under the speedy trial statute. And the problem with that is that if you're President Trump, obviously, you don't want to go to court on probably the most precarious of all of the criminal indictments in October. You do want time to prepare. Now, my sense is that President Trump and his attorneys have already strategized, they've already devised exactly how they will attack this case. And I do think that they have a more than credible shot, an extremely, extremely good shot, I might add, of dismissing the whole thing, not only on the grounds of immunity, but for some other reasons that we can discuss later. But the basic gist is that if the matter is removed to federal district court, then severance becomes essentially a moot point for them. There's also, Joey, the other matter of when and if the Attorney General for the state of Georgia will step into this matter. Under Georgia statute, if a case is removed from state court to federal district court, the Attorney General then steps into oversight. So essentially, Fannie Willis becomes, in essence, or in a proverbial sense, second chair and it would be up to the Attorney General for the state of Georgia to prosecute. And it could very well be that the Attorney General looks at the case in its totality and simply says, look, now that we're on the federal court level, I don't believe that this prosecution will be successful. There are many people who are talking about the chances of President Trump being acquitted. That's not the real concern for the prosecutors. The real concern for the prosecutors should be if there is one individual on that jury who was not willing to convict. The president could, of course, win by a hung jury, not by a full acquittal. So that's a major concern for any prosecutor, particularly in that district, that you could get one person on that jury who just simply says, I'm not convinced by any of this, and refuses to agree. 2 to 3 days later, the judge is essentially saying, I'm declaring a mistrial, or, you know, due to a hung jury, and we continue on with the chances or likelihood of a refiling being slim to none. So that's the second. But the other part to it is that if you're President Trump, I would want to get as far from Sidney Powell. I'm going to be very honest with you. I would want to get as far from Sidney Powell as possible in handling this case. And the reason is that Sidney Powell and a couple of other people who were named may not necessarily have conspired with the president toward an illegal end. And we can talk about what I consider to be the fatal flaw in Ms. Willis's RICO case. But they are responsible for some other collateral crimes. They may very well have done some other things that don't necessarily prove that President Trump did anything illegal, but they are necessarily illegal in and of themselves. So, you know, we talk about Kanye West, former publicist, posing as a police officer. There is possible criminality there. And what you don't want the jury to do is to associate you with any of these collateral crimes or individuals who committed it. Sidney Powell made some rather outrageous and outlandish statements about back doors into the algorithms for these voting machines being able to be changed. She made a number of outlandish claims that you can be rest assured the Georgia DA is going to raise in court. If you're President Trump, you don't want to be associated with those, you know, with that when those questions arise, particularly since Sidney Powell has already been found culpable in a civil matter. So if you're President Trump, you definitely want the rest of you, beyond the fact that, you know, you don't want this case to be heard in October, you definitely don't want to be associated with a number of defendants who could very well be found legitimately guilty for some collateral crimes that they committed, not necessarily related to the overall RICO charge that Ms. Willis has filed.
So let's say these cases do get separated, and let's for the scenario say former President Trump, he gets his own case, not connected to anyone else, but yet all these other people, they got their own separate cases. Is it possible that, you know, Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, that these people could ultimately get convicted, but the former president could end up getting cleared entirely?
I mean, anything is possible. You have to believe that. If each one of them have their own separate juries impaneled, you can never know what will happen. But what I can say is that the nightmare scenario for someone like Fannie Willis, or D.A. Willis, to be more respectful, the nightmare scenario is that you're going to have one Trump supporter on every one of these juries, because that one, if they will not be convinced by any stretch of the imagination, and there are a number of them in Fulton County, and there are a number of them that would be in the federal district, under the federal district's jurisdiction as well, that they're going to hang that jury, that jury is going to come back hung. They're going to say, look, Your Honor, there's one or two or maybe even three of us in here. We just can't come to an agreement, and they will hang the jury. There's also the possibility of full acquittal if President Trump's defense plays it. And I also believe, again, Julie, that I believe there's a more than credible shot, a far more than credible shot, that they could end up having the case dismissed altogether. But by the same token, there is a likelihood that you could see Sidney Powell convicted. You could see Chesbrough convicted. You could very well see, I don't know that you would see Rudy Giuliani convicted. I can't imagine that scenario based on the facts against him. But yes, I can imagine a scenario where any of them are convicted and President Trump walks free. It's one thing when you're talking about his attorneys. It's one thing when you're talking about his chief of staff. But this is the former president of the United States, who is the leading candidate for the Republican nomination and a better than on odds favorite to win in the fall of 2024. You better believe that that's going to be going through the head of a lot of these jurors and asking the question, is this really what I believe constitutes a crime for which the president should be imprisoned? Because that would be the ultimate conclusion. Do I believe he deserves jail time for this? And that's unfortunately the way that D.A. Willis has styled this. She didn't choose to sue the president, which would have had a financial penalty in the way that Letitia James is doing. She chose to prosecute him criminally. And you have to imagine what would be going through the head of these jurors. Do I believe that the president, the former president of the United States, should be going to jail for what is being alleged? You know, I could see a civil suit from D.A. Willis in which she's essentially saying, you know what, you know, where the jurors are going, you know what, he should pay a fine. Yeah, pay this judgment, not necessarily a fine, but pay this judgment. And, you know, that we consider to be reasonable, that can we consider to be adequate. I just don't know that you'll be able to put 12 people together in a credible voir dire where all 12 will come back and say guilty for the president. The others, I think it's a toss up.
Let's talk about this dismissal, because you brought it up more than once here. There are people who are skeptical about the indictment of this case, specifically the racketeering charges, as you brought, the RICO charges being used here, claiming that this is a little far-fetched in doing it. Now, of course, proponents say, you know, this is within the realm that this was a whole big operation and that the racketeer charges are justified. But what do you make of these as a lawyer who understands the law here? Is this going to ultimately be the thing that leads to the dismissal, or is it a little bigger than that? Because I know, obviously, you brought up some other reasons, but what is that thing that's going to cause this dismissal to happen?
Well, Joey, let me, you know, for, you know, in full disclosure to your listeners, I have never handled a criminal RICO case. But for the benefit of your listeners, many people don't know. In fact, there are a good number of attorneys nationwide who don't know that many states have a civil RICO statute. And it follows along the same script, but obviously the consequence or the judgment in a civil RICO suit would be financial in nature. It wouldn't be criminal. And so I have actually both advised and actually argued civil RICO cases. And again, it follows the same line. So I want to just be clear that my background and my understanding of RICO is really based on the civil side of it, not criminal. But having said that, for the benefit of your audience, I'm just going to give the briefest explanation. RICO, which is racketeering influence criminal organization or operation, it was devised as a way of countering organized criminality by essentially the mafia. They were the impetus for it. And what it essentially says is that if you participate or are a member of, a participating member of a criminal organization, that is an agreement between all of the members to commit an illegal act, your very participation, your very membership in that organization is criminal, right? So If you and I, Joey, decide we are going to go and steal cars, right? And we enlist a great, we enlist another getaway driver, and we enlist a chop shop in New Brunswick, and we all work together to go out and steal cars. Every single one of us can be charged under RICO, because the entire reason for us agreeing or coming together is to commit a crime, right? Now, let me change that scenario just a little bit. Let us say, Joey, that the two of us decide that we have to get down to the Jersey Shore for the last few days of this glorious weather, right? But we look around and we realize that we don't have any way of getting down there, so we decide to steal a car, right? And we steal that car and we drive down. Now we're picked up. RICO would not be applicable in that instance, because the reason why we decided to work together, our objective wasn't to steal a car. Our objective was to get down to where? The Jersey Shore. So if the objective of the agreement between all of the parties was something lawful, yet they committed some collateral crimes along the way, you don't charge RICO. You simply charge for the collateral crimes they committed. Now, how does that apply to Georgia? According to D.A. Willis, her theory of the case, and it's the only way she could charge all 19 defendants, it's the only way, her only shot to get President Trump was to charge him and the other 18 defendants with having committed RICO. She is alleging that the 19 of them conspired or agreed to commit an illegal act. Here's where the motion to dismiss comes from. It's a very simple question. What was the illegal act on which they agreed? What D.A. Willis has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt is that their agreement, which in this case was to keep President Trump in the office, to quote unquote find the votes, right? Is any of that inherently illegal? It doesn't become illegal simply because you stick the adjective illegal in front of it in an indictment. It doesn't become illegal in that way. It has to be something that would be ordinarily criminal according to the code. If not, then unfortunately, she doesn't have a case that ultimately ties all 19 together. She may be able to prosecute others for collateral crimes, many of which would be misdemeanors in Fulton County, but there's no possible way for her to prosecute all 19 defendants unless she can prove RICO, which myself and several other attorneys ultimately find wanting as a theory, because we can't discover what is the unifying or conspiring crime. Why did they get together according to the theory? Well, she says to keep the president in power. Well, that's not illegal. That's not illegal. The way in which you do it may be illegal. Again, that's the collateral crime, but that reason for which you do it is not. Never mind the fact that the group wasn't an organization. I mean, these were attorneys, federal employees, and the president. That's not an organization. Now, granted, you don't need it to be, but the very fact that they got together for a solitary purpose and then dissolved after it was all over kind of speaks to the fact that it doesn't quite fit the definition of organization that is implied under RICO. But for those reasons, I do believe President Trump and Mark Meadows and several other, their attorneys are going to argue that there is no RICO here. There is none. And if you don't have RICO, we didn't commit any other crimes. Therefore, the case must be dismissed. And that will be in addition to the president and Mark Meadows and Jeff Clark, all the government employees arguing immunity. that they have immunity from prosecution for acts that were undertaken in their authority. And I'll say this under the color of authority as government employees. And I'll say this very quickly, Joey. You saw that come out when Mark Meadows shocked everyone, including me, by testifying in his motion hearing to remove. He was on the stand for a little around, or approximately 5 hours. And during that time, the prosecutor from the DA's office, from DA Willis's office, tried to hammer him on defining what acts are within his purview as chief of staff and which actions are partisan and therefore outside of it. She tried to argue that this was a violation of the Hatch Act. You know, did you believe you were violating any Hatch Act? And Mark Meadows remained calm, he remained cool, and he continued to state that making sure that voting irregularities are addressed, if there are none, or if there are any, is well within the purview of the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. And so the DA was left arguing to the judge that there are some things that, yes, Mark Meadows did that fell within his purview, and then there are some things that are not. And therein lies the question. There are some scholars who, in reading the case law, both from the Supreme Court and from circuit courts of appeal, that say it's an all or none thing, right? There aren't this and that. I don't know that I necessarily buy that. And to the extent that it may be true, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. But that's the potential motion that is before the judge, or would be before the judge, to dismiss. I just don't find the RICO theory in this case, as iterated by DA Willis, to be compelling, even in the slightest.
Now, I want to move on to another case that is on the other side of the political aisle, and that is the one dealing with Hunter Biden. In a court filing, special counsel David Weiss says he plans to bring a formal indictment against Hunter Biden by the end of the month. This comes after the plea deal previously negotiated by the Justice Department and Hunter Biden's legal team fell apart in court back in July. What do you make of this development?
Well, Joey, the various convolutions of the Hunter Biden saga make for great legal drama. I'm sure that the public, to the extent that they've been paying attention, are probably as fatigued as anyone else. It seems as though every iteration of this saga brings with it an entirely new debate, political and otherwise. So plenty of reasons to be fatigued. It's a good thing that I actually love the law and I just pull up my chair with popcorn and read and watch it all with glee. But I'm a geek like that for the law. Right now, what we've heard is the rumor, based on some things that the House Oversight Committee, chaired by Representative James Comer, he has essentially said that he's uncovered evidence to show that the FBI was not fully forthcoming with David Weiss. So when Attorney General Barr turned this matter over to Mr. Weiss, the expectation is that the FBI would share all of the information with Mr. Weiss that they had in their possession so that Mr. Weiss could ultimately make the decision. What you're hearing now from certain outlets, most of them, I must admit, are quote unquote right-wing outlets, but you are seeing some more mainstream outlets report it, is that Mr. Weiss behind the scenes is essentially saying, look, I never knew any of this. And essentially the argument is, I would never have agreed to this plea deal. I would never have walked into it had I known what I now know I didn't know from the FBI. In the midst of that, because Hunter Biden was not being prosecuted, because the plea deal fell apart, Representative Jim Jordan and Representative Comer sent a subpoena to his attorneys demanding that they turn over all of their notes concerning the plea deal that fell apart. Now, obviously, his attorneys, I fully expected them to tell Representatives Jordan and Comer to pound sand. It was eventually going to go to court. I have every reason to believe that the judge was more than likely going to force them to turn over said notes. But in the midst of that, coming in off the top rope, if I can borrow from the wrestling term, is David Weiss now saying, U.S. Attorney Weiss now saying, oh, well, I intend to indict Hunter Biden by the end of the month with what we don't know. We know it's several things. We know what can't be indicted because of the statute of limitations, but I intend to indict him by the end of the month. Well, as a result of that, now what happens is that Hunter Biden can now claim the fifth, plead the fifth, so that he doesn't have to testify in front of Comer or Jordan's committees. And it also means that certain information that would necessarily be elicited about President Biden will likely be off limits because this indictment is forthcoming. Now, remember, just because there's an indictment doesn't mean that there is going to be a plea bargain, because guess what? If Hunter pleads, then Comer and Jordan can, of course, say, oh, well, I want that, right? If he pleads, then they can say, then they can say, oh, okay, well, then you're already pleading. You can't plead the fifth now, so we want this information. So essentially, David Weiss can then indict Hunter. It stops the clock that's ticking on any of the outstanding crimes he's committed. We don't know what those are yet because we haven't seen the indictment from Mr. Weiss. And then Mr. Weiss could theoretically, and understand this, Joey, that, and it has a number of us going, well, when is he going to set the date for trial? Because he could very well work with the defense attorneys to set the trial for, let's say, November 7th, day after the election. And if you listen to some individuals on the right who are more cynical of this move, what they maintain is that President Biden cannot pardon his son right now. The optics would look horrible. It would be disastrous. And I agree with that assessment. So the theory is David Weiss essentially indicts Hunter and then sets the date for trial somewhere late into 2024. And then President Biden, if he is still president, pardons Hunter Biden, or even if he's no longer president, and this is even more reason for him to do so, if he now knows that he's lost on his way out, he pardons Hunter Biden, and thus he gets what he wants. That's the cynical view on the right of what's happening, right? That's the cynical view on the right of what's happening. But just keeping it objective, it's a very interesting move now, Joey. It's very interesting. Very, very interesting what's happening with Hunter.
Now, I know we don't have the indictment in front of us, but Based on what you can suffice, what charges do you think it's going to be? Is it going to be just on the gun charges, or is it going to be related to the foreign agent charges? Because remember, that came up during the plea deal as well.
Sure. It very well could be the FARA Act violations. And the danger of that for Hunter Biden is that with FARA Act violations, there may very well be things that come out during the trial that would be of great interest to Jim Jordan and Comer, to Representative Comer, because the ability now to see what the FBI uncovered, where were these shell corporations, where did the money go, were there any of these conversations recorded, it's an extremely dangerous situation for Hunter if there is a FARA Act violation on the table. It's very perilous, and not necessarily for him, but if you follow certain legal luminaries on the right, they will tell you that it spells potential jeopardy for President Biden. Hence the reason why him pardoning Hunter would be extremely disastrous. I mean, the look of it you couldn't mitigate that. You couldn't mitigate that. It would give President Trump or whoever the Republican nominee is, it would give them the biggest drum possibly to beat against President Biden. But I will also point to the fact, Joey, there is some question about misappropriation. We know that on his taxes, he unfortunately indicated that he unfortunately indicated payments to prostitutes. There is a question as to whether he could be charged. I doubt it, but they could charge him under the Mann Act because he did bring a young lady across. I mean, she was an adult. I don't want to make it seem like she was underage. God knows he's already done enough horrible things. We don't want to give that insinuation. But he did bring a young lady across lines for the purposes of prostitution. That squarely fits the Mann Act violations. So we could see more than the gun charge. In fact, I do expect to see the gun charge there. And it's going to be extremely difficult for him to weasel his way out of it. And as I said to you in a previous interview, after the shooting in Florida, where you once again saw certain Democrats, although not as much, but you did see certain Democrats calling for tougher gun control laws, it's going to be very difficult for Hunter Biden's attorneys to argue that this was, you know, that it doesn't deserve the punishment that would be there. But I'm also expecting the FARA Act violations and possibly some others. So it's perilous, but the FARA Act violation I consider to be the most perilous for Hunter, even though the gun charge, I believe, if I do recall correctly, the gun charge would actually have the stiffer penalty, but the FARA Act violation is the most perilous if you believe the Republican line that Joe Biden is corrupt and that Hunter Biden was his bag man. What that trial may have uncovered, or what the investigators may have uncovered, could very well be disastrous.
We'll have to see where this case goes, as well as where former President Trump's legal troubles go. Rutgers political science and law professor Joe Leo Carney Warren, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
No problem, Joey. Anytime. And thank you for having me.
Well, that about wraps things up for me this week. Thanks so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on in the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on Twitter at @Block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. Now, you may be listening to this show for the first time. You're like, oh my God, I love the show. It's so great. But where do I find it? Well, here's what you got to do. You got to go to that browser of yours, whether you're on your smartphone, your tablet, your computer, you get the deal. You go there, you type in foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. You put that in, it's going to take you right to the podcast page with all the Fox Sports New Jersey podcasts. You're going to scroll down till you find In the Middle with Joey Block. You're going to click on that, and all the episodes will be there, with the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. So be sure to check all that out and stay tuned as we go into this campaign season. One, with the state legislative elections right around the corner, we're 2 months out from that. You want to stay with this program to get all the insight and all the information you need to know. Well, that does it for me. Thank you so much for listening. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.